Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Roberto Mazza, the host of Jerusalem Unplugged podcast. And today for the Middle Eastern Studies series, my guest is Shaul Adar. Shaul has recently written a book called On the Border, The Rise and Decline of the Most Political Club in the World, published by Pita Books in 2022. Now, Shaul is a journalist and he wrote a fascinating narrative that brings together both his personal life and experience, football or soccer, as it is known, the other side of the ocean, and the history of the club intertwined with the history of Palestine and Israel. So the book is very much about three narratives that always come together and they bring a bit of the personal, something about the club, and something about the larger history of Israel-Palestine. Obviously, we're going to talk about the history of the club and how it became not just the most political club in the world, but also a club that represents racism, fanaticism, and is often associated with violence. But first of all, Shaul, welcome.
Hi, Roberto. Thanks for having me.
Now, the first question I want to ask is very much about yourself. So if you can tell us a little bit about your background and also about the origins of this book.
Yeah, I was born in Be'er Sheva in the Israeli desert. Moved around Israel, university in Haifa, a little bit in Jerusalem, worked in Jerusalem for a few years, lived in Tel Aviv, and in 2000 I moved to England, and since then I'm living there in London, and well, until the pandemic, having a wonderful time, seeing lots of football, being journalist. It's my third book. The other previous two are in Hebrew, both about football. But as a journalist, I write about everything from politics to travel to art. So I try to bring it into my book. And I thought, what would be a good subject for a book? And for me, Bitar story is fascinating. But what makes it more poignant is the connection to Israeli politics and Israeli-Palestine history. So I thought it would be interesting, and I hope I wasn't wrong.
You are not indeed. I mean, the history of Beitar Jerusalem goes beyond the history of a football or soccer club. It's much more than that. And in fact, I just want to start asking you a few things about the history of football in Palestine. Now, your narrative, for those that are going to read the book, your narrative really goes back and forth from the present to the past and vice versa. And I was just wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about the origins of football in Palestine.
Yeah, like many other places, it was brought by the Brits via a religious school, St. George, if you know it, in Jerusalem, and other schools in the Middle East. It was also later brought via some Russian pioneers, some historians think, but it was formalized by the British after World War One, and they started a league with more organized game. The Turkish had a few more also contributed to the history, but and Atatürk played in Jerusalem against some Zionist team. But the big leap forward was with the British. They formed a league, a cup run, a cup tournament, and many rivalries and hostilities, which always bring something good. They thought that football will help bring the people together and deliver the balls to schools, Arab and Jewish one in Jerusalem and the area, but as we know, it didn't help any peace. But at least they tried.
Now, let me ask something about Beitar more specifically. Now, in the book, you make a very interesting statement, and you say that the DNA of Jerusalem, and you talk extensively about Jerusalem, the city, and its history, and you say that the DNA of the city and of Beitar are shared. So what does that mean, really?
I think it's the felt of importance, the grandeur, and the, unfortunately, the religions. If you walk in Jerusalem, there are some certain points where you feel the earth is shaking beneath you. It's everywhere you go, you see history, politics, religions, and tension and hate. And there are some places in the old city that you're 5 minutes away from the most important religious and political places in the world, places that one foot wrong can lead to a major conflict as it erupts once in a while. And Beitar also is also always on the verge of being political, and it's never just a, it's not like Maccabi Tel Aviv or Hapoel Be'er Sheva, who are football clubs and important football clubs or and important to the fans. With Beitar, you get the feeling that they represent much more in their own eyes, and then they, because of that, they think they're entitled to much more privilege than any other club. You can see, you can say it about Jerusalem. It's this, when we talk about the status of Jerusalem in Israeli society and politics, there's always big talks and how important and how central it is. But if you look more deeply, the city is poor, extremely poor, run down, getting worse and worse in the last 20 years, getting weaker economically, and it's parallel to the decline of Beitar. So, and still, they talk, they feel that they are the team of Jerusalem, the holy place, and hence you can't say anything derogatory about the club. But if you look more carefully, you see that it's shambolic and it's rotten from the inside.
We will go back to some of the question that you just mentioned there. But for the listeners, I was just wondering if you can tell us a little more about the origins of Beitar Jerusalem, particularly the connection with Beitar as a political organization.
Yeah, Beitar was the sport and youth organization of Herut, the predecessor of the Likud. We will use Likud just as shorthand. And at the start, it was meant to be a liberal organization with personal rights and equal rights to the Arab and Palestinians in the future society that will rise. But pretty fast, it turned into a nationalistic movement. And Beitar was formed in 1936 in Iran, Nevi'im Street, which is truly wonderful place to visit if you're in Jerusalem, and had some teething problem in the early years, was closed and reopened. And in the 40s, it suffered from all the way around. The more established Hapoel and Maccabi, sorry, I'm recovering from COVID, so lots of coughings. The more established political sport organization of Hapoel and Maccabi tried to ostracize them, and Beitar Tel Aviv, which was a very strong team. So Beitar was out of the center geographically and politically, and had to play a lot with and against Arab teams and Armenian teams, Christian teams from Jerusalem, which is quite surprising. And Omer Einav, with his very fascinating book, wrote about it. But it was a very tough childhood, especially when in 1947 the British mandate outlawed Beitar movement and they had to play under a different name. But it gave them sense of identity and sort of resentment against the established, more strong clubs and organization, which it's still part of the club, even when they were the strong establishment. It's a fascinating conundrum, which is a bit like the Likud. How can you be the ruling party for so many years and call yourself an underdog? But they managed to do that quite easily.
Well, there are conundrums also in terms of ethnic identity, which we will discuss later, sort of a question of the Arab identity of many of Beitar supporters, but also the hate that has been instilled against the Arabs. So there's also these contradictions that need to be explained later. But I wanted to ask you something about Tel Aviv. You already mentioned, you know, some of the Tel Aviv clubs. And one of the arguments that you make in the book is that football in Jerusalem developed differently from Tel Aviv. And I was wondering how and why.
The main reason is because Maccabi Jerusalem folded and stuff, and so there was a place for Beitar to evolve. There was only Hapoel Jerusalem, which enjoyed the support of the Istadrut, the working union, but it wasn't as strong as Hapoel Jerusalem. As Hapoel Tel Aviv. So for Beitar, there was a really open niche to develop and forge an identity and to become the second club of the city and then the first club. In Tel Aviv, it was much crowded space and much more competitive with Maccabi and Hapoel teams. So, football in Jerusalem was special in that specter. And also it was, I think, much more political than Tel Aviv. At some point, Maccabi and Hapoel Tel Aviv became more professional, more still hating each other with passion, still with some political connection, but much more as a, you know, as a fun fact. In Jerusalem, it's still extremely passionate. If you say Hapoel and Maccabi Tel Aviv, they hate each other because they're different teams. But in Jerusalem, they will go back to the 40s, to the persecution of the begging as a, the leader of the organization and the leader of the Likud. In Tel Aviv, I don't think you'll hear such things. They said, I hate Hapoel, I hate Maccabi, that's it. Because that's what we do as football fans. But Jerusalem, it's still extremely political and they never seem to get away from it, which I think would lead to their demise in the end. Help their demise. There's so many reasons.
That's a fascinating story, and it reminds me, like, everywhere in football you have these kind of rivalries. So you may be from Manchester and hate Liverpool, but it's not really political. It's about football and in an ingrained idea that they are your enemies. But you're right, here there's something different. And that brings me to the next question. In the book, you talk about the period of the early 1950s as one when Israeli football was violent, corrupt, and political. So can you tell us a little bit more about this period of time?
There was a big tension between the sports organization of Hapoel, Maccabi, and Bita. So if one team of Hapoel was running to the championship or trying to avoid relegation, all other Hapoel teams will help her, you know, in the sporting manner or non-sporting manner. And the same goes for Maccabi. The national team had a quota of 50-50 for Hapoel and Maccabi. And many results are extremely dubious. We have to take them in a pinch, with a pinch or a mountain of salt. There were some last games of the season with strange results. And in some cases, the whole season were voided because they didn't have any sporting merits. It was violent. I read a lot, many times, the official history book of Beitar, and there's lots of newspaper clippings there. And I was astonished by how many times there were violent affairs there, and how they mentioned it, you know, as a fun fact. The rival keeper had the three tooths knocked out by the Beitar fans, and it may have had some influence on the result. Something, you know, by the way, funny anecdote. So there were other violent events and in other grounds, but it seems that the YMCA where Beitar played was probably the worst. And later in the 60s and 70s, there were extremely violent events with Beitar fans that consolidate their notorious image in three events, two in Tel Aviv and one in Petah Tikva. People with machine guns run after the opponent players, and one referee, an immigrant from Russia, was chased by the Beitar fans, and they shouted at him, go back to Russia, it's pity that Hitler didn't finish the job with you. So it's more than an image, it's the history of the club.
Beitar Jerusalem, you already mentioned that, is not the only team in the city. You already mentioned Hapoel Jerusalem. And I was wondering if you can just give us a sense of how these derbies, and when we say derbies, for those that are not accustomed to football jargon, it literally means a game played by two teams belonging to the same city. So how these derbies played out between Hapoel Jerusalem and Beitar Jerusalem?
It was very hateful and political. Hapoel plays in red as a socialist club, and Beitar play with yellow just because one of the chairmen liked Brazil. But and they used a lot of political slogans. The Beitar fans came armed with rage. They felt betrayed by the country, by the political power of labor, and they felt that disrespected as people and as more traditional religious people than the secular Ashkenazi labor hegemony. And they felt that everything is harder for them, getting jobs, getting well paid. They're not well connected. They seem as outsiders to any of the Histadrut jobs. And they came with that fire to the derbies. And when they won one, they shouted, the Histadrut is mourning. The workers' union is grieving. And had a parade all the way from the YMCA to Strauss Street, if you know Jerusalem, just to celebrate outside the Histadrut headquarters. Hapoel always brought... which then was the leading team of the city, but had bad results in the derbies, always brought some local kingpins of the Labour Party to encourage, and had stirring talks before the games against those fascists. Although some of the players and the fans were actually Beitar supporters by heart and had to hide it. If you look at the papers from that time, each defeat was greeted with disproportionate reaction. You know, we lost to the horrible sacrilegious Labour, or how did we manage to lose our honor in front of those fascists? And some of it is still, if you go to Twitter before this year, last season, there began, you had some echoes of the past. Although, and about Apoel, did enjoy the support of the stronger political organization and financial arms of the Istadrut, but there always been some kind of schlimmizel, if you know the word. Not really that good. They had a good, and once they sold their home ground in Katamon and had to share the ground at the YMCA, they had a very short brief of success in the early 70s, but since then they've been on steady decline. Some truly shocking, horrible football disasters. And just in the last year, they managed to get back to the first division after many years outside it. So, in some way, Hapoel missed the opportunity to become... They had many years where they were the first team, the only team in the first league, and Beitar were languishing in the second league, but they didn't manage to get the support of most of the people. At best, it was 50-50 or even less, despite being the strongest club. And then they lost most of the fandom in the city throughout the years. But they managed to recover, and now they got some solid fan base, although in small numbers, but it's quite solid, and they got their identity back. With Beitar, we will speak about it soon. They're dealing with their own identity problems.
Hapoel Jerusalem is a fascinating story too, one of sort of a collapse and then rebirth. And I enjoyed reading, and I remember also the story about how fans basically built it back and eventually managed to bring sort of a second team of Hapoel back to, sort of purchasing the title Hapoel. So it's another fascinating story, but I want to focus here on Beitar Jerusalem.
I use the story of the new Hapoel Jerusalem as a metaphor for the liberal Ashkenazi Jerusalem, that it's been written down in the press so many times, that saying all Jerusalem is now ultra-Orthodox, religious, Mizrahi, Likud, right-wing nutters, and there's no hope for Jerusalem. And although the numbers of the secular community in Jerusalem are declining, never write them down completely. There's still big university, hospital, civil service. There will always be some very important secular base in Jerusalem.
And that brings me to sort of a central part of your book, which is like one of the most important aspects of your book, the question of Mizrahi Jews. So Beitar Jerusalem is deeply connected with this identity, the identity of, in English we may say, Oriental Jews, who in Israeli society have always been discriminated against. I mean, sometimes people forget that Mizrahi Jews coming from Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Egypt, they all had to go through camps, and then they were relocated in the periphery of Israel. Some sort of, second-class citizens, Obviously, the suspicions was that because they were Arabs, could have turned into a fifth column. So, and obviously here you see the sort of a big divide between Ashkenazi and Mizrahi Jews. And I was wondering, how did the club become associated with Mizrahi Jews? And also, how do you see this divide, Ashkenazi-Mizrahi Jews, influencing Israeli football?
Today, it's apart from Bitar, it's not a big issue because most of the players and many of the fans are Mizrahi. So there's no clear cut, you know. They play together, and only with Bitar, it's still an issue and identity. And I think it's mainly down to Menachem Begin. He made the connection. And the people, mainly from North Africa, Iraq, Iran, they were put in transit camps like the Ashkenazi because the new country was tiny and without resources. So everybody were put through the same process. But the Ashkenazi left much earlier for many reasons and got well-connected, got better jobs. And they felt more at home here, while under Ben-Gurion and his labor, the country was more secular, and sometimes you can say it was racist and with very dubious feelings about the Mizrahi Jews. But if you talk to people or read, the main thing was how religion was seen by the authorities. In the early years, Israel was much more secular than today, and many of the Mizrahi immigrants felt that they even tried to force them to lose their religion, and that is still a burning issue among them. And Menachem Begin used that extremely well to bring them into Herut and Likud, and also use the economic and the social discrimination against them. And most of them had more nationalistic feelings than the Ashkenazi, which is very fascinating issue, but it's been from the 50s. So they felt at home with the Likud, and they felt that they can't support a Hapoel team who plays with red, and they got a hammer and sickle on their badge. They felt it's, you know, abomination. So supporting a team who played with the menorah badge was much more natural for them. And the early years, the 50s and the 60s, when they were the second best team and had to fight the big Hapoel organization, it meant that the results were poor. But as building identity and camaraderie, it was excellent for Bitar. And it meant that this emotional ties between fans and the club were stronger than many other clubs.
This is a fascinating story of how politics, ethnicity, and obviously sport, they all come together. And that brings me to the question of trying to understand, when did the reputation of Beitar as a violent club with violent supporters begin?
I think it was the key events were 1969, if I remember correctly, the events at Bloomfield against Hapoel Tel Aviv, which I mentioned earlier, where there was some soldiers on a day out from the army with a machine gun getting into the pitch and chasing the center forward of Hapoel Tel Aviv, who nutmegged them. And then they burned the crossbars and the nets and destroyed the stadium, more or less. That was one event. And the second one was in Petah Tikva in 1970, 5 or 4, I can't remember. I can look it up. In a cup tie against Hapoel Petah Tikva, which was also very one of the old guard of Israeli football, very the most successful team in the 60s, Hapoel team. And Beitar lost the cup tie, and they trashed the stadium. They chased Hapoel Petah Tikva fans to the orange orchids outside the stadium. And they sent players and fans to hospitals. People were fearing for their lives. And astonishingly, the chairman of Beitar, Lazy Rivlin, the brother of the future to be Ruvi Rivlin, the president of Israel, demanded a technical win for Beitar Jerusalem on some ridiculous ground. They never felt the need to be accountable, even when it was clear cut. There was another event against Hapoel Tel Aviv in Bloomfield in 82, and together with smaller incidents, it led to the image or perception or the reading the situation that Beitar is the most violent team in Israeli football. And I don't think they're quite embarrassed by it. If they want to make home games in Jerusalem as hospitable as possible, there are some low-key events all the time, especially when they play against Hapoel Tel Aviv and the Arab teams. So there is a base to the feeling. It's not just the terrible Tel Aviv Ashkenazi lefty media who are after them. It's much more, let's look at the history, and it's quite obvious.
In the book, I would say that in every chapter, you can find descriptions of various football games or specific seasons, which also are intertwined with the history of violence. But there's one specific season that caught my eye, and that is 1975-1976, which marked, for the first time, a battle between two Mizrahi teams, so two teams that represented Oriental Jews, Beitar Jerusalem and Beersheba. Now, Beersheba is an interesting club too, is obviously in the periphery of Israel, and perhaps some of the listeners are not familiar with this team, which in the past few years had been rather successful. In fact, they also became very popular throughout Europe when they, a few years ago, they actually beat Inter Milan. So obviously that gave the team more notoriety. But I was wondering if you can take us through a little bit this 1975-1976 seasons and why the history of these two teams became intertwined.
Yeah, I was a kid living in Beersheba then, going to almost all the home matches, so I remember it quite clearly. The year earlier, Beersheba won its first title. And although it's an Hapoel club, it was the team of the periphery, or the team from the desert, non-Tel Aviv club, the first team outside Tel Aviv and Netanya to win the title. And it was a homegrown team. Only one player was from outside the Beersheba, and it was it told you that something is happening in Israeli sport and Israeli society. Beitar in 75 was relegated, but because the league was so corrupted, all relegations were frozen and they got stay of execution, thanks to Ehud Olmert and another member of the Knesset who led the demand, which was with a good base. I think it was the right decision. And in 75-76, a young player in name Uri Malmilian came through the ranks of Beitar. He was born just outside the old city walls of Jerusalem, then still under Jordanian rule, playing under snipers' attacks once in a while. And he was proper first star of Beitar Jerusalem. He was a humble, very likable guy, an outstanding player. And he transformed the history of the club from really second-rate club to a club who started fighting for titles. And that season, Hapoel Be'er Sheva looked like winning another title easily, especially after they won at YMCA. And then they stopped. Something in the last third of the league, internal squabbling and rifts tore the team apart, and they stopped winning games. And Beitar closed the gap to only 2 points in the last game of the season. And Be'er Sheva had an easy home game, which I went to, against Maccabi Yafo. Beitar had to play against Maccabi Tel Aviv in Bloomfield. And there was the usual radio program of the day was canceled to keep everything more sport-like. And to our astonishment, Be'er Sheva lost that game 1-0, missed the penalty, and we thought that the title was lost. And we waited for the result from Tel Aviv until it came, and Beitar lost to Maccabi Tel Aviv. So Be'er Sheva won its second title, Beitar lost its first real chance of winning the title, but still had the cup final against the same Maccabi Tel Aviv 4 days later, in what was became the really major point of history of Beitar. They played in the final in really packed Ramat Gan Stadium, and they won it under the stardom of Uri Malmilian, and became, I think we can say, a team with a national appeal. They broke out of the Jerusalem boundaries, and everyone. And then there is the question, did it help the Likud win the general election of 1977? I don't know. Begin don't think so. He told Ehud Olmert that it didn't matter. People would have voted for him anyhow. Other political correspondents think it brought more energy to the Likud. On the symbolic level, yes, it was very important, and it was a good foreteller of the political fortune of Israel. Beitar winning its first title, Be'er Sheva becoming a dominant team, a team of the periphery, and then the Likud winning the election for the first time in 1977.
You already mentioned that, obviously, the Beitar Jerusalem is deeply connected and associated with the Likud party, which, again, for the listeners, we should say is a right-wing party. But I was just wondering, how did actually Beitar become the team of the Likud party? Was just the agency of Begin and other politicians, or how did play out this sort of relationship? And also, how did racism and bigotry begin to affect Beitar? Was it connected to the ideology of the Likud party, or it's coming in from grassroots associations or society itself? Which also brings me to the last part of this long question. Beitar Jerusalem is known for disgusting, because it is what it is. The motto, forever pure. Can you tell us how that became part of a team too?
Well, it's going to be a long answer. First of all, Beitar and Likud or Herut was also always intertwined. If we look at the first Beitar team from 1936, there were people who later became ministers of Beitar, playing for Beitar, Chaim Korfu. And throughout the years, players and especially chairmen and activists in the club became ministers. One of them, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, and one of them, the President, Ruvi Rivlin. So it was always a good place to start a political career. to some degree. I don't think it will help you if you're not a good politician or not a popular. It wouldn't build you a political career out of the blue. But if you have those two together, it's a very important force, as we've seen throughout the years. Remind me of the middle part of the question.
The middle part of the question was very much about the question of racism and bigotry.
You could always sense some hostility, but it became clear and outspoken, and, you know, without any guilt or shame in mid-90s. There were two reasons in my eyes. The Oslo process, which many people felt threatened by it, the way of life, the security, and the future of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Israel and mainly Jerusalem suffer horrific terror attacks, which I had the traumatic memories of hearing those explosions, you know, I don't know, 500 meters from me. So it's a sound you don't forget in a hurry, not even 30 years later. Life in Jerusalem was tough those years. Bus exploded. Parents were worried all the time when their kids left the house. People driving stayed away from buses at traffic lights. And tension was rising high between Jews and Arabs, Israelis and Palestine, and left and right. And another reason was the rise of Arab-Israeli football. Suddenly there were more and more Arab-Israeli footballers, you know, Arab citizens of Israel. They were playing in the national team. There were Arab teams from Arab towns and cities playing in the second and first league in bigger and bigger numbers. And so now the racist fans of Beitar, not all of them, I'm always making this point, not all Beitar fans, but very big proportion, more than any other club, had someone to hate in arm length. They could shout those racist songs and chants. It wasn't something obscure. And the key point that other clubs, with the rise of the Arab-Israeli football, recruited the players. If you look at Maccabi Haifa, which was the strongest team of that era, or recent teams of Hapoel Be'er Sheva, they got very strong base of Arab players. They're now the 20% of the players in the top division. And in sporting manners, you're harming yourself if you exclude those players playing for your team. And you can't, I don't think that there are many nationalist Likud and the other parties who support all the clubs in Israel. But once the team playing with three Arab players, I don't think they will feel at ease to chant, to sing those songs. With Beitar, it became a raison d'etre for many fans, for many organizations. And it's a dynamic. Many of the normal fans who just want to see football got away and away from the team, disgusted and felt that they can't support it anymore. And more people who like those racist tones much more than football become attracted to the club. So everything become accelerated. More and more racist fans and less normative fans. And it all came to a head in 2013. in the notorious Chechen affair, when the club had signed two Chechen Muslim players for dubious reasons. And big chunks of the fans refused to accept it and fought it till the end, until they got chased away. And the symbolic part was during the first game after the signing of those players, a banner was raised in the stadium saying "Beitar forever pure," and there's no way of hiding it. It's a Nazi overtone. It's a racist, you know, talking about racial purity. You can't hide it or avoid it. And it, since then, Beitar is struggling. From that specific moment, they suffer economically. Sponsors left the club at that moment. One sponsor signed the deal a week earlier, and once that sign was raised, he left the stadium and at the parking lot told the marketing director that the deal is off. And since then, the club is toxic, is stained, and some of the chairman and the owners try to fight it, and it cost them dearly. And the main point is, those fans of La Familia organization had the door open for them by a previous owner, which was very tempting things to do. They supported the club, they, you know, brought color and supported the owner. But once things went downhill, you can't turn it back. They're part of the club, and it's like getting rid of a cancer. You need a very agonizing period of therapy, and until it happens, the club is suffering.
We will talk about La Familia just in a couple of minutes as we reach the end of the interview, but I want to ask you something about the question of Arab football in Israel. You mentioned earlier about 20% of the population in Israel is Palestinian descent. And as you mentioned earlier, in the past few years, they've become more prominent in Israeli football. And not just as single players, but also as clubs. And one of them, Sakne, became a winner. But also it sort of brought more clashes, particularly between Beitar and Sakne. And I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about the club, the Sakne, and also how their clashes with Beitar develop.
Yeah, they rose in the early 2000s. They weren't the first club, the first Arab club in the first league, in the first division, but they were the most successful. Other clubs went up and down, and some of them really disappeared. But with Sakhnin, they're here for over 20 years. They got relegated twice and bounced back immediately, which shows you that they are part of the first division, and they won the cup in 2003 or 2004, which was an historic event in Israeli football. The Beitar fans organization turned the website black for the day to show the grieving. But Israeli football in general welcome them. You can say there's a bit of sport washing element. But in general, it's positive. Israeli football is one of the most welcoming and open spheres in Israeli society. It's based on a merit. If you're good enough, you'll play in the top teams and the national team. So there were some cases, there were five players in the national team. And some people didn't like it, but for most people, it's fine. There's no problem with it. And Sakhnin is becoming more and more nationalistic by themselves. You got a feeling that they do enjoy those clashes with Beitar. It's good for their image, it's good for their business, it's good for identity, it's good for bringing the fans together. And you hear more and more nationalistic chants about Al-Aqsa, about Jerusalem, about, you can see Palestinian flags in which you couldn't believe it 20 years ago. And they're not the good Arabs. They enjoy the provocation. So it's going to be interesting in the coming years. And they're trying to, they don't have the financial muscles of Maccabi Haifa and Hapoel Be'er Sheva and Maccabi Tel Aviv, but they do try to bring the best Arab players to the team. So it will be interesting. And it's, they do enjoy the demise of Beitar. You can see it on the social networks. There is a little anecdote about how many Arab players scored against Beitar and then took the Muslims' bow, which enraged the Beitar fans even more. And it became part of the Israeli football mythology that most Arab players will eventually score against Beitar. Sorry.
Let's go back to La Familia. You mentioned this group, and I was wondering if you can tell us what it is, La Familia. What is this organization, and why are so popular in a sense, and how comes they are so powerful?
They started as a group of fans in the early 2000s, and then with the help of social media and the internet, everything was much easier to form and liquidize, to establish. And they did enjoy the last period of success in Beitar in 2007 under Arkady Gaidamak, who opened the doors for them. But then came Gaidamak, left the team to hang out and dry, cut his financial support of the team. But Beitar stayed with this burden of La Familia. And then they become much more about the politics and the Arab hatred than the football. They see themselves as a political organization these days. You can see them in demonstrations, supporting Netanyahu, or during clashes and riots or nationalistic events in Jerusalem. They are there with the black and yellow outfits, and quite proud to be La Familia, the political branch. And they are in big numbers, and they are violent, and during the internal conflict of the Chechen years in 2013, they kicked out anybody of the Eastern stand in the Teddy who wasn't one of them, who was too open-minded, who dared to support the team. And the clashes, this civil war is ongoing now for 9 years. Sometimes it's more obvious, sometimes it's more relaxed. But even in last year, Beitar signed a Muslim player, which was a big step forward. And it was accepted by most fans for the first time. It wasn't a repeat of the Chechen shame. And some fans choose to support the team and that specific players. And La Familia attacked them physically. It did help the normative fans to get together and so, and, you know, voice a resentment against La Familia. They're calling them cancer in social media openly, which they were afraid to do a few years ago. They reject them in the stand, but they got big numbers and big support, and it's like toothpaste. You can push it out of the tube, but it's extremely hard to push it back. And once the racist feels at home, they're not going to live off their own accord. You got to do something. And there is a constant battle against them. That's why I wrote in the book that Beitar is not a racist organization, but it's under racist influence. Of course, it can change if new owner comes and stop the fight against them. But at the moment, many fans try to resist it. But at the moment, it doesn't. It looks like hard work. I don't want to say it's impossible, but until Beitar will change something basic, which is to become a normal club with Arab players, I don't see them living away. And that would be the best way to make them live and form their own hideous, little, nasty, racist, forever pure Jerusalem club. And hopefully, but it's, I'm not sure that this, that day is close.
Now, throughout the book, you talk about the various owners of the club. One actually is a very sort of a funny, but also dramatic story of this guy, Guma Aguiar. But that's one story. Now, like many other clubs, obviously Beitar changed hands several times. And I was wondering, how did money change the club and its perception? And also, can you tell us a little bit more about the 2020 failed takeover by an Arab, a very shady individual, from the Emirates?
Beitar is a sick organization with very low natural defense. So it attracts weirdos, dubious characters, in some cases, sadly, people who are not that stable, like Guma Aguiar, who had all the best intention and was a charming personality, but suffered from serious episodes of mental health, which Jerusalem exacerbated. Jerusalem and Beitar, living in Jerusalem, going back to your question about the DNA, makes everything more political, more dramatic, more emotional, and more important. And people think that they're not just the owners of a football club, the owner of Jewish pride and importance. So that make everything more radical. Going back, so Beitar attracted lots of owners who came as a messiah and turned out to be false messiah quite rapidly. I've made a few times a list of the most bizarre and most eccentric owners, and the list just getting longer and longer. In the last year, there were three of them. And one of them was the royal from the UAE, who was supposed to buy 50% of the shares of the club. And it led to major demonstration for and against the move in Jerusalem. And it turned out there was nothing behind it. It was a front for something we don't know. That guy didn't have enough money. His capital was in the state bonds of Venezuela, who you can guess not worth a lot. He didn't have enough money. Everything was extremely shady, and it fell apart after a week of publications. The media did an excellent job of exposing it, and the Israeli FA didn't let this shady deal go through. And now Beitar is stuck. It's another crucial week this week for them. They need to find a new owner, and the rumors are rife, and I can't quote them without a lawyer sitting next to me. But going over the Beitar feed on Twitter, you don't see a lot of happy faces. It's either they will get relegated this week by the FA, or they got new owners that most of the fans don't trust and don't like and don't feel that his interests are in saving Beitar. They're hinting quite worrying hints, let's say. And we'll see in a few months' time or a few years' time. It looks like that years of neglect, racism, and dubious honors are costing Beitar quite heavily, and now they're paying the price. It's really hard to see them forming any team close enough to the big three of Israeli football. But we'll have to wait for a few days.
You just served me the perfect assist using football jargon for the last question. So where is Beitar directed in contemporary Jerusalem?
It's a great question, actually. Beitar is less and less a Jerusalem club, which is another reason why it's suffering a lot. It's as Jerusalem becoming more orthodox, religious, ultra-orthodox city and poor city, the numbers of people who buy season ticket or tickets or going to Beitar games is getting less and less. So they got more fans outside Jerusalem. And as you know, traffic in Israel is an ongoing disaster, especially to Jerusalem. There's no train service and the club refused to play on Saturdays, on the Shabbat. So they want to have all the cakes and still eat all the cakes and still have it. To be a Shabbat observing club in a city without enough fans, and to still have a big support base. And it doesn't happen. The numbers of people going and paying for Beitar are miserable compared to Maccabi Tel Aviv and Maccabi Haifa. So economically, the club is suffering in the most, you know, important and basic way. And the racism attracts not just the football fans, it attracts the political fans who want to shout death to the Arabs. So everything unleashed is, you know, they need to find a way to reverse the history, to become a clean club with much bigger fan base, and to become a club that it's nice to go there and watch a game. For many Israelis, football is an escape from the horrible politics and the daily tension of the Israeli-Palestine conflict. So you can go to Be'er Sheva, see the team win 3 titles in a row, 2 cups, and enjoy yourself. But if you go to Beitar, you're reminded about the conflict all the time. So it's not fun. So they need to do that. They need to attract more of the secular population of Jerusalem, which now they have a fight on their hands against Hapoel Jerusalem and against the splinter club of Nodia Jerusalem, who wants to have a open-minded, liberal Beitar team, like the old Herut base. So it's getting harder and harder. And I was attacked for saying that obvious thing, but it's time for them to look at reality, stop playing the victim, and read the map. I don't know if they'll do that because it's much easier to play the victim, but it's their problem, not mine.
This was Shaul Adar, author of On the Border, The Rise and Decline of the Most Political Club in the World, published by Pitch Publishing in 2022. Shaul, thank you so much.
Thank you, Roberto. It's been a pleasure.